Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control, control that determines global economic winners and losers and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution. She's the founder of the Public Banking Institute and a prolific contributor to the growing discussion about the evolving world of economic theory. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments within the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen. Money,
get away. Thanks, Walt. Well, Scotland had its vote for independence on September 18th, and the noes won. That means Scotland remains a vassal state of the UK. My latest article was written right before that on how Scotland might achieve not just political independence, but economic independence by forming their own state-owned bank on the model of the Bank of North Dakota. The good news is they could still do that. After all, North Dakota did not break away from the Union in order to form its bank in 1919. What it did achieve independence from was Wall Street and the big bankers who were putting its farmers into foreclosure unfairly. So Scotland could do that too, and they really should do that because it's one of the few ways now that they can achieve some economic independence. I had given a presentation on that in Scotland in, I think, November of 2012 and wrote an article on it in December of 2012. My presentation was followed by one by Ralph Fleischman, who invited me to speak there. I spoke at the Royal Academy of Arts in Edinburgh, and he presented on the facts and figures for Scotland, what they could actually do with their own bank and how much money they could save. He pointed out that Scotland already has a government-owned bank called the Scottish Investment Bank, but it's not a depository bank. So if it were a depository bank, it could substantially expand its credit power. If you're a revolving fund, if you've only got a certain amount of money to lend and then you lend it out, you have to wait until it comes back before you can lend it again. But if you use that same money as the capital base for a bank, you can lend up to 9 times your capital because you only need 10% capital as against your loans. So at that time, in December of 2012, the Scottish Investment Bank had £23 million to work with. So by forming their own bank, they could actually have close to £230 million to lend out. So that's one way that Scotland could achieve some economic independence, even without having political independence from the UK. Another way is proposed by my guest today, Chris Cook. My guest today is Chris Cook, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Security and Resilience Studies at University College London. He actually lives in Scotland, though, in Linlithgow, which he can tell you about. Chris was director at the International Petroleum Exchange, IPE, which traded Brent crude oil until 2005. He was the originator of the Iranian oil bourse being a market, I think, a commodity exchange for trading petroleum, petrochemicals, and gas in various currencies other than the U.S. dollar. He wrote a very interesting article on posted on September 2nd, on how Scotland could achieve economic independence even if it failed to achieve political independence from the UK, which, of course, is what has happened. So, greetings, Chris. Great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Ellen.
So you've written a really interesting article on how Scotland could establish its financial independence. But first, I wondered if you could explain what the whole push for political sovereignty was all about and why you think it didn't succeed.
Well, it's been a fascinating last couple of years, really. There's been a push for independence for a long, long time. It goes back maybe 30 years. But gradually it's gained traction over the last maybe 5 to 10 years. And in fact, the political party which currently governs Scotland is called the Scottish National Party. They got a majority 3 years ago, and they were able to get from the UK government an undertaking to hold a referendum vote, which recently took place last Thursday. And that vote was a lot closer, I think, than the Westminster establishment thought it would be. In fact, at one point, when it looked as though it was actually going to be a yes, we found half of Westminster come flying up to Scotland and all sorts of promises being made in relation to devolution. So basically now the question is being asked in Scotland, well, to the Westminster, did you really mean what you promised us? Because the analysis, Ellen, is very interesting, that the people, the 55% who voted no, if you go above the age of 55, then there was a majority against independence above the age of 55. Every generation below that, and the younger that you got, the more actually voted for independence. So the 16 and 17-year-olds actually had the highest proportion of yes. And what we're looking at is basically that the people with the most to lose, which is the older generation who have basically lucked out, the baby boomers, if you like, they were the ones who had the most to lose, and they were the ones who decided they didn't want to lose it. Whereas everybody else, particularly the cities with the most working class, if you like, Glasgow, voted yes. Dundee, even poorer in many ways, they voted yes. So it's been quite interesting in terms of demographic as to who voted no and why they voted no.
Yeah, I saw a really impassioned speech by a young woman from Glasgow. You might have seen it. I don't remember her name, but she had like flaming red pink hair and a ring. A ring and a thing in her nose. So, definitely of a different, and she was talking about, I mean, she said several times she choked up, and she was talking about how skills are not valued anymore. It's all about finance capital, and finance capital has won and is steamrolling over them. So, and then I saw another video about how there was some issue about whether the elections were honest. It looked like that it might have been rigged. Of course, that always
No, I don't give any credence to that, actually. But certainly...
It's controversial anyway, yeah, the whole thing.
Well, there are always controversies, and some people, get very disappointed and will look for any, will look for reasons to overturn the result. But, I mean, I've met people, Ellen, I met one of the returning officers, a local council chief executive, and I listened to what she had to say about the process and how it was done. And I think you may see apparent discrepancies in videos and whatnot, but there is, I haven't come across any that couldn't be explained, you know. So, sorry, Ellen, go on.
Oh, I was just going to get into your article where you discussed the tally sticks. I know you'd written about that before, and I actually quoted you in my last book, The Public Bank Solution. But I thought that was a great analysis that, the way I wrote it was the tally sticks were considered debt, but they weren't. I mean, when the Bank of England took over, that was considered government debt, but it wasn't actually debt. It was, as you point out, it was credit. So can you, and you're suggesting something modeled on that. So can you explain the tally sticks and how that worked?
Yes. I think there is a lot of misunderstanding as to the nature of credit and the relationship between credit, currency, and debt and the different types of finance capital. I mean, David Graeber, for instance, he wrote about 4,000 years of debt. And the anthropologist, and he referred, of course, to tally sticks in his book. But I don't think he or many people have actually understood what it's all about. Accounting tally sticks are accounting records. It's very simple. You took a stick, you cut notches in the stick, which were the number of the sort of, if you like, the unit of account. And it was a record of a transaction that you did with the counterparty. So you would cut the notches and then cut the stick in two. One counterparty kept one part of the stick and the other counterparty kept the other. And that was how records were kept. And that's before double entry bookkeeping came along in the Middle Ages. And people started writing the transactions down using the principles. Now, there are two types of tally, as they called it. There were, and this is not widely understood. One was called a memorandum tally, and that was essentially a receipt, a proof of payment. So if I'm the king and I sell you some land, one of the records of the transaction would be the tally, that you would retain one half of the tally stick and the exchequer would retain the other, and that would be a record that you had paid, proof of payment. And that was called a memorandum tally. And now the other type of record was called the loan tally. And that was more to do with a promise as opposed to a future transaction rather than a past one. So this is not at all widely known, that how the kings came to raise money was that they found that they weren't raising enough tax to cover their expenditure. And they would go to a taxpayer and basically say, look, how would you like to prepay tax? And prepay is a word I'll come back to because it's extremely important. How would you like to prepay tax? And you would maybe do a deal with the king and you would say, well, hang on a minute, I'm not due to pay my tax yet. So you would demand a discount. Okay. So the king would basically say, okay, you may prepay £10 and give me £8 worth of your servant's time or wheat or barley or gold or whatever it was the king needed. So you would therefore make a £2 discount on an £8 prepayment. And that transaction would be recorded by the loan tally. The king would give you a tally stick, or half of it, which you would then return at the time in which you were due to pay tax. And that's where the expression, Ellen, that the tax return expression comes from. It was a physical return of that token to the exchequer when it would be matched, and you couldn't counterfeit these things because you had the grain of the wood to match them with and other markings. And that's where the expression tax return comes from. But also, everybody's heard of the expression, or everybody in finance has heard the expression rate of return. Well, that was the rate at which you got the discount. It was the speed, if you like, with which you made your profit on the discount. So that you were going to make a £2 profit on an £8 investment, if you like, your prepayment. But the question was, how long would it take you to make that? If you paid £10 of tax in 1 year, your rate of return was £2 divided by 8, 25% per annum. If you paid only £5 tax in a year, it was 12.5% per annum. And if you paid £2 tax a year, it was 5% per annum. In other words, you would take the absolute profit you made and divide by the number of years over which you made it. And that was where the expression rate of return came from in the first place. But what's absent from that model is compound interest. There was no money for the use of money. What was happening was value over time, which was whatever value the king provided, was being exchanged for value over time for whatever the creditor provided. And that mechanism of prepayment and that instrument of credit was basically that it was the basis of the economy for literally hundreds of years. This was the case when it came to merchants. The merchants, their credit was good, so that a merchant, when he actually received something or bought something from an individual, and maybe the merchant didn't have something that the individual needed, he would give his token instead. And in due course, the creditor would find that, well, he could actually present that in payment. Instead of gold, he would give back to the merchant his IOU in due course. So these tokens, this technique of prepayment at a discount, it exists, and not just exists, it's actually re-merging back into use at the moment. I could point you, for instance, Ellen, to a transaction recently done between Russia and China in $85 billion crude oil prepay deal, because the Chinese actually were prepared to prepay for crude oil at a discount, and the Russians needed money to repay the banks who had lent them money to purchase a big company. This is a form of capital, a form of financing, which is not debt, which is not equity in terms of shares. And now I'll come to the killer point. The token that was handed over to the creditor was called the stock, and the other half of it was called the counter stock. So when we talk about stock exchange, we're not talking about, we're talking about shares in a joint stock company, shares of common stock, that's equity. And the other one is interest-bearing debt, which is called loan stock. So in fact, this third form, this original form of finance capital, which has been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years, I believe is actually emerging or re-emerging in use, because it works when the other ones don't work. Sorry, that was a very long explanation, Helen.
No, but it's very interesting. I keep envision, well, I hear about it and I'm trying to envision, obviously we need some sort of new system. The current system has failed. And what's missing is that all money we now know is created as debt. It's created by banks as debt, but it's always sort of backward-looking debt. Like you can, the haves can get credit. The have-nots don't have anything they can get credit with. But if you were allowed to get credit on your future promises, your future potential, or say you had some brilliant idea and you could show your business model and this was how you were going to pay back the loan, so that it would be the same thing where you'd be basically getting credit for future repayment. And I've heard of these various exchanges where you go, they give you some credit when you go in the door. And then you can buy everybody else's products with that credit, and that's what gets the ball rolling. And you put, you post something for your credit, you know, in case you don't pay. But yeah, so I think it's a really interesting model.
Well, what you're describing there, Ellen, is very interesting, because I distinguish between two types of credit. One is, people call it unsecured, but I think of it as people-based. It's based on the capacity of people like you and me to provide goods and services, or even something like care, for instance, to look after people is valuable. And then the other one, the other form of credit, is based upon the productive value, for instance, the use of land or energy. And we don't think of it this way, Ellen, but two-thirds of all money ever created is actually based on mortgages, on mortgage loans created by banks, the credit created by banks, but secured against land. So I think of that as money which is based on people but backed by land, if you like. Most dollars are actually land-backed. They're backed by the value of the USA and its land. And, you know, that is not widely understood, that actually, you know, see, the basis of credit isn't the bank. The bank's just the middleman, Ellen. He just, the bank just stands in between me and you, you know, or it stands between me and the land, in a sense. What I'm about, what I've been working on for the last 20 years, 15 anyway, is, well, what does the next generation look like of credit which has no middlemen, right? It's, I talk about Napsterization. You remember Napster, where a 19-year-old invented file sharing and single-handedly made the business model of the music industry redundant, you know? Well, the beauty of Bitcoin, I'm not talking about Bitcoin as a currency, I could come back to my view on that, but Bitcoin, its disruption is that it enables people to bypass the banking system. That's what's disruptive about Bitcoin. It's not the currency, it's the protocol, it's the system. It's the, that's the radical point about Bitcoin, is it enables people to bypass banks in the way that Napster essentially enabled people to bypass the music industry. And, you know, it's sorry, go on.
I can see that for, if it, you're basically talking about barter, but when you get to issuing credit, which is what businesses need to run on, it seems a little more complicated. You had mentioned that you can eliminate the middleman to intermediate credit risk, but it seems to me that is pretty much the good of the bank, that if you went to the grocer and you said, you know, take my IOU, I'll pay you on Friday, the grocer probably, or at least my grocer, wouldn't take it because he doesn't know me. Maybe in a small town they would. The bank will give you credit because you fill out all their forms and you show them how you're going to pay it back, and they know where to find you, and they're going to charge you interest on it. So it seems to me that's, and if you don't pay, they will absorb they take the risk that you won't pay, and that's why they charge you interest, because they're going to absorb that risk through other people who are all paying interest, sort of covering for each other's defaults.
Okay, well, so you put your finger on it. Well, what the banks currently do, the way I think of it, is the banks are essentially guaranteeing. What the bank's role is that of guarantee. They guarantee the performance of the borrower. They come between the, you know, the depositor and the borrower, and they guarantee the performance of the borrower. And in order to do so, they essentially put their capital, you know, a pool of money, if you like, behind that, and they take the hit if there's a default. Now, there's more than one way to skin that cat, Ellen. In London, ship owners had a problem because they went to Lloyd's of London, who insure ships, you know, which is a middleman, but there were certain risks which Lloyd's of London would not take. And what the ship owners then did was club together, okay? They formed clubs called P&I, Protection and Indemnity Clubs, P&I clubs, and they mutually insured certain risks that Lloyd's of London would not take. And what happened was they appointed a broker called Thomas Miller, and Thomas Miller didn't take the risk. They managed the mutually taken risk by the ship owners, who obviously put money into a pot and did reinsurance and things like that. So what I'm saying is it is possible to take an approach like this, and I use the expression guarantee society. Imagine that in your local town, or I talk about in Linlithgow, and we're looking to prototype this. Imagine that all the Linlithgow businesses become members of what I call the Linlithgow Guarantee Society. It's just an agreement of mutual guarantee. And on the other side of the coin, you've got the Linlithgow people who actually shop with the Linlithgow businesses. And the reason that the Linlithgow businesses extend credit to me would be that we have a mutual guarantee that I will perform. Now, how the system works, and it's very straightforward, is that what Linlithgow businesses would do would be to pay some money into a central fund, and the customers would pay some money into a central fund, which would be a default fund, okay? And they would also pay somebody to actually operate the system and to manage the risk. So what I'm saying is that system that I just described, Ellen, do you know what that's called? That's called Visa. That's called MasterCard. Except that Visa and MasterCard are owned by the banks, not by the traders and the people who actually use it. Dee Hock, you remember Dee Hock, who actually set up Visa? He dreamt up the, you know, he called it the chaotic mechanism, which... and I think it was in San Francisco that he first did it, that basically he linked together the different banks and the banking systems for sharing information. And he always wanted the customers to be stakeholders within Visa and MasterCard. But guess what? The banks never allowed it. Now, in Visa and MasterCard, the sellers, the merchants, pay a great deal of money for the use of the system. The buyers pay a great deal of money for the use of credit if they don't settle the balances. What I'm describing, it would be completely possible, very straightforward now, to create a local community credit card. You could even have it on the mobile phone. In fact, in Africa, that's probably what will happen. Completely possible to do that. And basically, you will have credit limits managed by a service provider formerly known as a bank. That's why, Ellen, I talk about we need banking, but we don't need banks. We're moving from banks as middlemen to banks as service providers. And the beauty of that, sorry, Ellen, I keep talking. I don't give you a chance.
Oh, no, don't worry. I was just going to ask you a question. So the bank, who would determine credit risk? You still need a bank for that, right? Or is that what you mean by service provider? Like somebody looks
you
at
would,
your property,
yeah.
what you've got, what you're going to put up, how you're going to pay, all that.
Exactly. How it would be based with unsecured credit is basically you're looking at people's capacity to pay. So every credit decision which is currently made, yep, you would need just the same credit decision. You'd need to handle defaults just the way you do now. But the beauty for the bank, you see, Ellen, is their capital isn't at risk. All they're doing is providing a service, and the best quality of service would be the ones who actually got to manage the local community credit. What I've described to you is not a million miles away from systems. You know the one in Switzerland, the VIR, WIR?
Right.
Which is...
Well, it's also very similar to a public bank, which is what I've been
yep.
pushing for all along, where it's owned
yep.
by the people, so the people get the profits.
Yep.
And,
yep. I mean, the only difference is that it's not the bank itself that takes the risk. The risk is essentially shared, but you could argue that that's what a public bank does anyway. You know,
right.
So, but what I was describing in my paper is that, you know, I was sort of, what I just described to you was the unsecured credit, you know, the, if you like, the credit that we need for the circulation of goods and services and for the production of new productive assets. But I also talk about the need for, there's much more credit required than that. And that is the credit that we need to, you know, which flows from the land, which flows from energy. I talk about energy credit and energy currency. And I talk about local currencies being based on land value itself, for instance.
And how would that work? It sort of reminds me, is it anything related to the Georgist plan to... tax the land, but not the improvements?
Well, you know, when I talk about banks as middlemen, I also talk about government as a middleman too, because they, if you think about it, that's what a government is. And, you know, they on the one hand, the government will spend on something, and on the other, it will raise taxes to fund that expenditure. And people actually vote for the expenditure which they want, and that's what government does. But it's possible to imagine another way of doing this. I mean, imagine, for instance, as a sort of thought experiment, that a community decided that, okay, we'll apply, let's call it a land value levy. I mean, call it a tax if you like. And that levy, which is not based on the improvements or buildings on the land, but just the value of the land itself, would go into a pot. It would then be immediately, without touching the government, distributed to equally to everybody in the area, as I call it, a land dividend. Okay, so you basically, you know, make a tax on the use of land, and then immediately redistribute to everybody in the area. And what you're then doing by doing that is essentially saying, well, those people who have the most use of the land, the commons, if you like, make a net transfer to those people who have the least. Now, the innovation which I'm proposing is that, well, that distribution would not be in dollars. That distribution would be in credits. Those credits would be what you need. So you would have, let's call it a land value credit, a land rental value credit, whatever you like to call it. It would be a $1 worth credit, and you would distribute it to everybody in the vicinity, and they would be able to use it to pay their obligation in tax or levy. So if you owned the place you live, you could then actually use that credit to pay your own levy obligation. If you didn't own the place you lived, you just rented it, then you could pay your rent with it, because you could give it to the landlord and he would have to pay his obligation with it. And what you're then doing is getting the basis of a local land value tax, but also those $1 denominated tax credits or levy credits are a form of currency. That's what they are. And they would begin to circulate as that. And people would then start making, you know, exchanging them and maybe investing them. So that is a possibility as a policy, if you like, of making a local levy, pooling it, and sharing it out equally to everybody who happens to occupy the land. And that is a way of bypassing even a government. In that model, it's an inherently cooperative model. And you can do the same with carbon. Ellen.
I sort of missed the step. So you're issuing these credits to start with from nothing, like you just print them up?
No. What you do, the first thing you do.
You pay.
What you do is you.
People have to pay it.
Yeah. You make a levy. The levy is paid by people in presumably in dollars. Okay. And then what you do is you issue to everybody in the vicinity. Let's call it a land dividend, if you like. So everybody gets an equal land dividend, but it's not paid out in dollars. It's paid out in essentially local currency credits, which you can actually use those dollar-denominated credits to pay your levy with. What you're essentially doing is creating a currency based on the tax obligation, if you like. That's the way it works. And in doing that, you actually are, you mentioned Georgism, I think, you're actually redistributing or sharing the value of the land commons in one sense, but you're also coming up with a methodology for creating a local land-based currency. And then if the local people say, okay, well, we're actually going to start issuing credits, you know, prepayment of these of this land levy, it's when you get to prepay, Ellen, that things start getting very, very interesting. But that was just a thought experiment. It hasn't been done anywhere. It's just my point that you don't necessarily need to have a treasury or a central bank between citizens. That's the point I'm making there.
You mentioned the Hong Kong system where they don't have a central bank, but don't you sort of need some sort of central bank for liquidity? Or, I mean, even the Bank of North Dakota uses the Federal Reserve or the Federal Home Loan Bank.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so how do you work without any sort of backup?
Well, in Hong Kong, what you have is three banks, same in Scotland actually, which issue credits, their own credit, banknotes in this case, and also that sort of virtual credit as well. And there isn't a lender of last resort in Hong Kong, okay? Wherever there's a central bank, the central bank acts as a lender of last resort. And what that means is that the Hong Kong banks typically are much better capitalized than banks in other places because there's nobody there who's going to bail them out. But on top of that, Alan, while there isn't a central bank, there is the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, okay? So, you know, when I mentioned the shipping P&I club, as it was called, Hong Kong's a bit like that, where you actually have the monetary authority doesn't take the risk, but it manages the issuance of credit by the private banks. Yeah. And that essentially is what I'm advocating in Scotland, that the treasury, in my case, you're looking at a treasury could issue credit. Okay. And although the bank wouldn't have a bank, the banking function would be that the banks would manage and allocate the issuance of the credit that was necessary. So essentially, the banks become a service provider in the model which I described. They manage the banking risk or the credit risk. They don't take it themselves. Okay? And they would have a stake. Obviously, you'd need the banks to have a stake in the outcome, otherwise they'd grant credit to everybody, to all and sundry. But, it's possible for the Treasury to... And if you think about, actually, the structure of every banking system, the Treasury, it is, who has the central bank as what I call the fiscal, well, people call it the fiscal agent. What you see, the Federal Reserve is actually creating dollars, which the dollars that the Federal Reserve creates are not Federal Reserve credits, in fact. They're Treasury credits. That's what they are. I mean, people don't understand that that's what modern money actually is. Okay, it's the same in the UK. It's the same with every central bank. People think that the, you know, that the Federal Reserve actually lends money to the US government. It doesn't. It's the agent of the US government. Okay, and the smoke and mirrors that actually cloud that reality. So the Federal Reserve spends and then lends to the banking system, but it does it as the agent of the US Treasury. Because a U.S. Treasury bill spends just the same as a Federal Reserve note, okay? In fact, there are still, I understand, Treasury notes still in existence. And during the First World War in England, the U.K. Treasury issued notes called Bradburys, which were £1-denominated Treasury bills, and they or notes, and they spent just the same as the Bank of England notes. So my point is that the central bank actually is, it doesn't do, it's not a counterparty with the Treasury, it's an agent of the Treasury. And people do not understand the difference, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's very technical. I don't understand either. I've heard that said, but I don't quite understand. I mean, we don't use U.S. notes anymore. We use debt. The government issues debt, and then it gets bought up, including by the Federal Reserve.
Yep.
But my
case, Ellen, is, and this is such a difficult thing to get your head around, my case is that, in fact, we call it debt. You know, Treasury bills and Treasury notes and UK gilts, gilt-edged stock, in fact, we call it debt, but my case is it's not debt at all. It's actually credit. It's more like equity. Imagine that it's US Incorporated, okay? And imagine that US Incorporated has preference shares, $1 preference shares, which bear interest. That is what US Treasury so-called debt is. It's not debt. It's equity. And it always has been. It's credit, not debt. But everybody calls it the national debt. But it isn't. I mean, how can everybody, Ellen, in the world be in debt? You know, how can every central bank in the world be in debt? Who to? You know?
Right. I've made that argument too, but it is hard
it's crazy.
To persuade people. How do we change the language so that they see the debt as the money supply?
Oh, they see it as debt. Of course they do. But, you know, when people talk about, oh, we've got to run down the national debt, we've got to reduce the debt. If you do that, Ellen, you're literally putting the country into liquidation. That's
right.
What you're doing. It's completely insane because this fiction that we've come up with about the national accounting system, you know, it is a complete fiction. And it's a fiction that suits the people who've got all the money. You know? You know? It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah. I'm still mystified myself about how derivatives work. And you might, maybe, well, I had this vision. I saw this website that said liquidity is the new capital. And the point of the website was to show big banks how they could satisfy their liquidity requirements. So now, just recently, the Federal Reserve, along with the OCC and the FDIC, came out with these new rules where they have to have 30 days' worth of liquidity. But what they call liquidity are treasuries, understandable, and corporate debt. I mean, corporate stock and corporate bonds, but not municipal, state and municipal bonds, which is going to drive the interest rates up on the state and municipal bonds, it seems like. But anyway, this whole concept, that it seems to me that capital really, I mean, there's nothing backing our money. If you look at the whole derivative scam that's up to $2 quadrillion or something like that, it really is all liquidity. I mean, it's like keeping all these balls in the air so that they're moving so fast that it looks like there's something there, but there's really nothing. It's like a quantum wave versus particles. There's no particles there. It's all waves. that look like a currency, like a currency of water, you know. Anyway,
well, I take a slightly different view with derivatives. I mean, I was a director of a derivative exchange, and that was to do with basically futures contracts for energy, future delivery. But what blew up the financial system wasn't the futures contracts on derivatives in this case. It was things called credit derivatives, as you'll know. And what a credit derivative is essentially a way of actually, it's almost like an insurance contract. It's sort of like an insurance contract with a date on it that a loan or a package of loans created by banks were essentially insured by investors. So investors would receive money in return for taking on the credit risk of the banks on particular packages of loans for a particular period of time, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it was. Now, if you think about it, what was going on during this crazy time was that the banks were offloading some of the risk, because the whole point of a bank is it's what we call a risk intermediary. It stands between the depositor and the lender, and it takes the risk. And what credit derivatives enable banks to do was to essentially reinsure that risk and therefore free up some of their balance sheet, which meant they could make more loans. And people thought of this, you've heard the expression, dicing and slicing of the risk, you know? And the risk was diced and sliced so much with the derivatives and with the different other instruments, which were, you know, securitization and whatnot, which took place, that by the end of it, nobody actually knew where the risk was. And the credit rating agencies, you know, they made the big mistake of AAA rating these bundles of securities that came along. And unfortunately, what they were doing was AAA was saying, well, a AAA apple is the same as a AAA pear, you know, when in fact the risk of the apple is completely different from the risk of the pear. And unfortunately, you know, as we saw what happened, the whole system collapsed in 2007-08, and it's never going to come back the way it was, thank God. My view is we're going through a transition to a different system, because the existing system is completely and utterly broken. It's never coming back the way it was.
Yeah, I agree. Like you, I lie around thinking of how we can work it out better.
Well, I would just say that I'm an optimist, Ellen, because I believe that cutting out the middleman by getting direct peer-to-peer credit, which is not the same as peer-to-peer debt. If I give you my IOU and you can give it to Walt and he can give it to somebody else and it eventually comes back to me and I accept it, that is what I mean by peer-to-peer credit, okay? That is the way that you get systems like Ripple, for instance, and you may have come across Ripple. Basically, you know, people are able to accept each other's credit within a framework of a mutual guarantee. And the other form of credit, which I get excited about, I talk about peer-to-asset credit, or what I call prepay. Imagine prepaying 20 years worth of rent at a discount, or prepaying, you know, 50 megawatt hours of electricity at a discount. I believe that those instruments, those very simple energy credits or land rental credits, those will be the currencies of the future. And they're direct. You have no middlemen. It's not the government as a middleman. It's not a private bank as a middleman. But it does require management by service providers. That's the future in my view.
All very promising, I think. Food for thought, for sure. I like the way you...
Well, if you're an optimist, Ellen, you only ever get unpleasant surprises.
Right. I guess I'll just slip in one more question. There's this issue about whether, or a fundamental problem with the system, is that banks create all of our money as debt, and they always want more back than they create. And so in order to get that interest, somebody somewhere has to take out another loan, and so it's really a pyramid scheme. So that's called the debt virus theory. But then Steve Keen, for example, argues that that's not true because of velocity of money. But it doesn't seem to me that the velocity of money is going to fix it. There's still not enough money out there at the end of the day to pay principal and interest when the bank only created principal. So what's your feeling on that?
Well, I think what's missed is that the banks don't just lend, they also spend. And in order for the system to balance, the banks also create the necessary money to cover the interest charge as well. And I think that's what's missed, actually, Ellen. It's a simple matter of accounting balances. I don't see that the debt virus actually works, but I don't think Steve Keen's quite right in the way he describes it either. I think there's a misunderstanding of the way in which the mechanics of the system work, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know.
They create money out of nothing and spend it, and they don't they create it as a debt? I mean, I could see where government, for example, in Pennsylvania, in Benjamin Franklin's time, the government issued the money, and they had a bank. So they issued, most of the money went out in the form of loans, but they also at 5% interest. But then they also could issue money and just spend it. But a bank can't just issue money and spend it. Doesn't a bank? It can only issue money in the form of debt, right? Which is always
That's what's missed. When banks create money, what they create is not bank credit. What they create is treasury credit. Okay? It doesn't look, this is not visible to people. It's essentially, what the banks do is essentially, one could say, counterfeit treasury credit, because it is exactly, it's fungible with treasury credit. They create that credit and then they lend it or they spend it. What the banks are creating, Ellen, is not bank credit. That's what's missed. It's treasury credit. People call it cash. It's virtual cash. But that's what banks are creating. And they're essentially doing it as sub-agents, if you like, of the central bank. That's my analysis, Ellen.
They can create all the money they want and spend it, and they never have to pay it back?
That's because money isn't. It's the money that modern money is treasury credit. Okay. Now, they in fact they wouldn't get very far if they did just keep spending, because you know at the end of the day they'd have to balance that by their capital. Okay. I mean, there's no point in them doing that because the system would be out of balance if they did. What they're in business to do, how banks make their money, Ellen, is they create a loan, okay, let's call it a 5-year loan for the sake of argument, but once a day they have to balance their books by funding it with a deposit on the other side, okay, of the balance sheet. Their accounts receivable and accounts payable at least once a day have to be in balance, okay. And that's when the system clears once a day. So, you know, how they make their money is on the difference between the debt interest which they receive and the deposit interest which they pay. That's it, it's in that margin. That's where the banks make their money. Okay, and that's what a bank business. They're an intermediary. They're a middleman. They stand in between the depositor and the lender. And, you know, the fact that they manufacture the credit, and this is essentially treasury credit that they manufacture, is not understood. And the other point, finally, to make is that when loans are repaid, Ellen, the money is not destroyed. Not in my analysis. I might be wrong, but in my analysis, the money is not destroyed. And that's because it's treasury credit that only the Treasury or the central bank can destroy. Okay, that's Chris Cook's view of the system, if you like. I might be wrong, you know. I disagree with quite a few people, but that's my analysis.
Uh-huh. Well, definitely food for thought. I'll have to see if I can get my head around that. All right, well, that's been very interesting. Great talking to you.
It's been a pleasure, Ellen. Thank you very much for inviting me on. Thanks. Bye now.
Bye.
This week's public banking report looks at Santa Fe's Banking on New Mexico Symposium, which is scheduled for this weekend, September 27th. Santa Fe is one of several cities that has now embarked on a formal process of preparing for creation of their own public bank. One of the founders of the Santa Fe Initiative is Craig Barnes, who talks about what some of the generating concerns were that got them started.
Many of us here in New Mexico have been looking at public banking, been looking at trying to find ways to respond to plutocracy, plutocracy is such a big issue. People would say, we talked about it. Everybody said, yeah, we've got a country that's run by big money. But where do you put the lever? And the more we looked at that question, the more we saw we came up against the axiom, whoever controls the money supply controls the empire. That was Ellen's revealed that in her first book, The Web of Debt. We began to see that, and especially national politics, being taken over by billionaires didn't provide us much of an opportunity to regain traction at the national level. But if we could find a way to finance our own needs in our own local area and keep our money local, we might be able to just keep on developing and prospering without taking on Wall Street. So that's how we first got interested in public banking. And then we went to a Public Banking Institute symposium in San Rafael, California, and we were inspired. You guys just did a great job, just a great job. And so we came home and said, okay, we're on the right track. We realized we had a huge education to do before any city council or any mayor or any state legislature could feel comfortable. So we started working last fall on the idea of what we then called a big event that could draw people to it and bring the public discussion into the open for large numbers of people. So that symposium is now happening on Saturday, the 27th of September, here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It'll be all day with workshops on money, banking, ways in which alternative currencies can be used. Gwen Hall-Smith will be here. Ellen Brown will be here. You will be here. And we'll have people from all over the country, and even Dr. Keitel from Germany will be here to talk about public banking all day, September 27th, in beautiful
Santa Fe. Yeah, beautiful Santa Fe, indeed, yeah. The title of the symposium is Banking on New Mexico, Funding Sustainable Local Economies. You've got terrific buy-in from your mayor and your city council already. Tell us how that came about.
Well, we've had one of the reasons for looking at the city rather than at the state level was that we know these guys. We know people who are on the council. We knew the candidates for mayor this last spring. And Javier Gonzalez, when he was running, we invited him to have a meeting with us to talk about public banking. He immediately liked the idea and immediately began to campaign on it as one of the things that he would do if elected. In March, he was elected, and he immediately contacted us and said, okay, guys, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to do this? We said, well, we've got a symposium, September 27th. He said, yeah, that's great, but I need to start the process sooner than that. How about a meeting of officials from around the state and around the city in June? And with Mayor Gonzalez's leadership, we brought Gwen Hall-Smith and Mike Krause here, and they made a presentation to the mayor and council people with a considerable support and success. And we also had opinion leaders from around town come. So we were cooking. We were on the road to keep it going for September 27th. The mayor he's cautious and aggressive at the same time. So let's keep this going, but let's not leap ahead of the studies we need to be able to show the public this is a good idea. So a request for qualifications has already gone out and is being responded to now by people, I think, around the country. And that will be followed by a request for proposals to describe the feasibility of these various requirements that Mike Krause has instructed us so much on, and Gwen, too, requirements for governance and capitalization and legal issues, mission, all of that. So the city will be asking respondents to the RFP to lay out a way to approach those issues.
Are there particular financial needs or issues that Santa Fe is wanting to address with this idea?
That, of course, is critical. I mean, why do this if all the existing systems are doing the job? And in meeting with Mayor Gonzalez this last week, he said, you know what I would like to do? He said, I'm terribly interested in early childhood education. I'm interested in providing city Wi-Fi. I'm interested in citywide Wi-Fi. I'm interested in underwriting or helping underwrite smaller banks in their capital with their capital requirements for jobs they cannot now undertake. I'm interested in small businesses. So he had a range of things in his mind, which are clearly unmet needs by the current banking system.
Well, that's quite a menu, quite a wish list.
It's appropriate to have that list in front of us when we think of what we might accomplish or what is possible. And especially that wish list is of big projects which are not currently of interest to the Wells Fargoses and not are too big for the smaller community banks. It is in that niche that public banking can have its greatest impact.
Are there stakeholder groups, civic groups, other community organizations that are participating in discussion of mission?
There will be. The discussion of mission hasn't been formalized yet, just as the discussion of governance and those issues are not formalized yet. But the conversation lays out, and we're talking to the mayor about it, and the mayor is going through these proposals first, but the conversation will include stakeholders from unbanked, the agricultural networks, the places, the resource centers, the people in town that haven't currently been able to find what they need, Native American issues, infrastructure issues, underbanked people, small business. All of those stakeholders will be presenting at the September 27th symposium. And what they're going to do is say, we've got some systems going, we've got some development funds, we've got some community banks, we occasionally get help from the larger banks, but we aren't able to do what needs to be done here in New Mexico to get this job done. So we need to find some other sources of capital that can help us do these big projects.
And what are the finances of Santa Fe like? Are you hard-pressed for cash, or are you guys pretty flush, or what's the picture?
Well, I'd
there?
Say hard-pressed is the standard conversation. And the issues that the mayor ticked off that I spoke of a moment ago are issues for which there's not current funding, so that in order to advance our capacities, we're going to have to find ways to pay for it.
What kind of support and or feedback have you been hearing from local press, other community people? What's the scuttlebutt there?
Well, there's quite a lot of buzz about the symposium itself on September 27th, which is encouraging. There's been some press coverage, some inquiries from representatives of various press groups who will probably be coming. And we've also been getting a beginning interest of bankers and former bankers who are saying, what are you doing here? What's going on? Will this really work? So that's beginning to take shape, and we've had some very good conversations with mostly retired former bankers, bank executives, who said to us, tell me how this works, and that's uh-huh. the process we're in.
Right. They make valuable allies.
And that's exactly right. We are not, those of us who've been leading the conversation in the last 2 years are not bankers. We are going to need the leadership of some very skillful, very highly qualified real bankers.
Any pushback from the big banks on this initiative?
I think so far they were under the radar. When a bill for a state bank was introduced at the state legislature 3 or 4 years in a row, the big banks were quick to get it killed there. So I think when they won't pay attention here until it becomes a little more significant. And after this September 27th symposium, I would expect we may get some pushback.
Well, we look forward to being there and seeing the results and following this really closely. Craig, thank you very much for your update on this.
Thank you, Walt. It's great to have you interested. We'll see you when you get here.
That was Craig Barnes of Santa Fe's Public Banking Movement. You can stream the proceedings of this weekend's symposium by visiting bankingonnewmexico.org. And that does it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guest, Chris Cook, in Scotland. You can podcast this and other editions of the show at prn.fm. And remember that you can read and subscribe to Ellen Brown's latest works at ellenbrown.com. On behalf of Ellen, I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for listening. Money.